This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's show will feature an interview with Peter Cole, translator and editor of the new book, The Dream of the Poem, Hebrew Poetry from Muslim and Christian Spain, 950 to 1492. Before I get to that interview, though, I'm going to play a song that is based on a poem by the great Spanish poet Federico García Lorca. The poem is Sleepwalking Ballad. The song is Verde. The musical group is Manzanita. Before I play the song, I'm going to read just the first two stanzas of Lorca's poem, Sleepwalking Ballad. Green, I want you green. Green wind, green boughs, ship on the sea, and horse on the mountain. With shadow at her waist, she dreams at her railing, green flesh, green hair, and eyes of cold silver. Green, I want you green, under the gypsy moon, things are looking at her, and she cannot return their gaze. Green, I want you green, great stars of frost, come with the shadow fish that opens the road for dawn. The fig tree rubs its wind on the sandpaper of its boughs, and the hill, a wildcat, bristles with maguey spears. But who will come? From where? She stays at her railing, green flesh, green hair, dreaming of the bitter sea. Now, here is Verde, performed by Manzanita.
Quiero verde, ya, ya, yo a ti te quiero verde.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple. Did you know that Hebrew culture in medieval Spain experienced a renewal that produced a very powerful body of poetry? This poetry fused elements of East and West, Arabic and Hebrew, the particular and the universal. Its subject matter includes wine, war, friendship, erotic longing, wisdom, fate, grief, and both metaphysical and religious mystery. Jerusalem poet and translator Peter Cole has edited, translated, and introduced a very interesting and amazing book, really, called The Dream of the Poem, Hebrew Poetry from Muslim and Christian Spain, 950 to 1492. The book, published by Princeton University Press, guides us through the entire period. It includes 400 poems by 54 poets, along with short, fascinating biographies of each poet, and has a riveting historical introduction. In addition, there's an extensive notes section at the back of the book that provides every scrap of information needed to complete this educational and entertaining work. I was fortunate to sit down for a conversation with Peter Cole in October 2007 when he was visiting San Francisco from Jerusalem. Let's go now to that conversation. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
So this collection of poems is from medieval Spain, and it's being called the most powerful body of Jewish poetry written since the Bible. That's quite a claim.
It is, but I think it holds up to that.
There are about 400 poems, 54 different poets, and one of the things that really has fascinated me about the book is that you have a very full introduction to this book. You also include short biographies of each poet, and then you have an extensive note section. I really feel like the notes could be another book, turn into another book very easily. Before I move on, I want to let the listeners know that the original Hebrew texts are available on the Princeton University Press website.
Right. Yeah. Maybe I should just say something about how I've built the book.
Absolutely.
And why I've done it that way. quite a few people have told me that they expected when they heard about the book, they expected as you had said earlier, a small volume of poems with maybe a short introduction, which in fact is the way that most books of poetry and translation are presented. But my feeling here is that the world out of which this poetry emerges is so fascinating and is so little known, and I myself so thoroughly enjoyed immersing myself in it that it would simply be a shame, having done all that work and spent all that time unearthing all this material, to just leave it behind and present only the poems. Secondly, I felt that that readers would simply be interested. It is such a fascinating world, and it is a world that is so relevant, I think, for our own time in many ways. Mm-hmm. So I devised a way to present the poetry as poetry, unencumbered by notes. The poems are on the page by themselves. There are no footnotes or asterisks or numbers anywhere on the page, apart from line numbers. And then I put all the material, as it were, the poem is the tip of the iceberg. The rest of the iceberg is in the back of the book. poets, readers can follow up in any way they'd like. And I think it's a method I've used for my earlier volumes of medieval poetry, and I think I don't have the approach or the attitude that a lot of translators have, which is the poem has to be presented in its purity, in isolation. I don't think that's true. Poetry is part of a larger culture in all cases, in our case now today, and why should we hide the rest of that culture? It's as interesting as the poetry.
It absolutely is, in this case especially, and I really appreciate the way that the book is structured, because we get to look at the poems just clean on the page without any distractions,
exactly.
and yet you turn back to those notes and you are riveted by the information about the poet.
Right. And there's another aspect of it too, which is that poems are not really meant to be read once, whether they're old poems or contemporary English poems. The thing about a good poem is that you want to return to it often. And the notes, in a sense, help you turn to the notes to find out more. And what you find in the notes brings you back to the poems or to other poems. And it sets up a whole series of echoes and bits of conversation that are carried out across centuries. And that, to me, is the way poetry works.
Mm-hmm. Great. Tell me about the Spanish miracle.
The Spanish miracle is a phrase quoted by a man named S.D. Goitein, who was one of the great scholars of the 20th century. And Goitein is somebody who spent the entire second half of his life researching and writing about the entire Mediterranean world, in particular the Jewish aspects of that Mediterranean world, in as much as it involved Arab society and Islamic civilization. So he knew as much about this material as anybody ever has. And yet, despite the fact that he knew so much about the history of Judaism and this period in particular, when it came to describing the sudden emergence of the poetry in the middle of the 10th century, pretty much out of the blue, he could really come up with nothing except to call it the Spanish miracle. How this poetry emerged suddenly after virtually 1,000 years of relative silence on the literary front, and Hebrew, for him, seemed miraculous. There had been poetry in Hebrew, but it was liturgical poetry. Mm-hmm. It wasn't what we think of as poetry. It had a very restricted range of subject matter. And then suddenly, in the middle of the 10th century, Hebrew poets begin, in imitation of Arab poets, begin writing about just about everything under the sun.
Well, it's a hybrid verse, and it leads back to the middle of the 10th century, when a Moroccan poet by the name of Dounache Ben Lebrat arrived in Cordoba. Is that right?
Right.
And he made his way there from Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
He was in his 20s, and one of the quotes that you have attributed to him is, "Let scripture be your Eden, and the Arabs' books your paradise grove."
Right. Dounache had gone to Baghdad as a young man, as a student, to study with the greatest Jewish figure of the day, who was the leader of the Jewish Academy, Hebrew Academy, in Babylonia, in Baghdad. And that man, whose name was Saadia Gaon, had really spearheaded an entire cultural renaissance in the world of Hebrew letters and Hebrew, the study of Hebrew, Hebrew religion, the Jewish religion, by, again, turning to the Arabs as a model for intellectual models. And by then, Jews were speaking Arabic, and this is important to keep in mind that Arabic was their mother tongue. Mm-hmm. Hebrew wasn't their spoken language, although it was a language that they learned from the age of 3. So Hebrew was something they knew very well. It was very intimate for them. But the language of daily life and of study was Arabic. And Dounache got this idea, immersed in that Arabizing world of Baghdad, came up with a way of adapting some of the meters of Arabic meters to Hebrew. And with those meters came the entirety of the Arabic literary tradition. Mm-hmm. And that's what he brought back with him to Spain. And those lines that you quoted, "Let scripture be your," how does that go? "Let scripture be your Eden, and the Arabs' books, your paradise grove."
Yes.
Those are the lines that are definitely by Dounache. They're part of a longer poem. The rest of the poem is lost, but they in many ways stand as a kind of motto for the entire period.
Well, you name what you call 4 giants of Hebrew verse in Spain, and you can correct me every mm-hmm. time I say a name wrong, but mm-hmm. they are
Shmuel HaNagid,
Shlomo Ibn Gabriel,
mm-hmm.
Moshe Ibn Ezra,
right.
and Yehuda Halavi.
Yes.
Those are the 4. Right. Before we move on to those 4, though, I want to start with the wife of Dounache. It's the only poem, as far as you know, by a woman in the entire medieval Hebrew canon. And I suppose partly because the men were educated because they studied scripture and the women were kept quite illiterate.
Exactly.
For the most part. And this poem,
well, not necessarily illiterate, but they didn't learn Hebrew.
Okay.
They may well have learned Arabic, but they weren't brought into that circle of religious study in the same way.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. Well, she composed a poem on the occasion of her husband's forced departure from mm-hmm. Spain, which that's another whole story to begin with, but right. Why don't we read her poem?
Yeah, this is a marvelous story in every way. The first aspect of it that is, to go back to Guaitain's phrase, the Spanish miracle, the first aspect that's miraculous is that we have the poem at all, mm-hmm. because this is a fairly recent discovery. It was discovered by a scholar working in Cambridge, England, about 30 years ago. So prior to that, we had no knowledge of this poem or of this person. We don't know her name. We just know her as the wife mm-hmm. of Dunash. And we had had a fragment of this manuscript. It had been torn vertically. So we had a bit of the poem and a bit of a heading on it. And the headings to these poems, if there are headings, are usually written in Judeo-Arabic, which is to say in Arabic, but in Hebrew letters.
Oh, interesting.
And the heading that we had, just the left side, said Dunash. And so the fragment had been put in Dunash's collected poems. We only have a small part of what Dunash probably wrote, but there was a volume published, I believe, in the 1930s or 40s of Dunash's work. And this fragment was included, and it was considered Dunash's. And then this scholar working in the library, because he knew all the work very well, came across, by chance, the right side of the page. And he recognized something in it that made him think of the other missing side. And he eventually put the two together like a jigsaw puzzle, and then the heading became complete. And it said Dunash because it said that this was written by the wife of Dunash on the occasion of
Fantastic.
His forced departure. Yeah. So we don't know exactly why he left, but it appears that the head of the Jewish community, he may have had a falling out with him and had to leave. So the wife writes to him or writes a poem to him or about, really not to him, but about their little ceremony in which they exchanged some items of clothing and some jewelry as he went off, and she was left holding her baby in her arms. It's not clear why she couldn't go with him, but that's the way it was. This is also, in addition to being the only poem by a woman, it's also one of the only poems, I believe, where an infant child is mentioned. Will her love remember his graceful doe, her only son in her arms as he parted? On her left hand he placed a ring from his right. On his wrist she placed her bracelet. As a keepsake she took his mantle from him, and he in turn took hers from her. Would he settle now in the land of Spain if its prince gave him half his kingdom?
Stunning. Thank you so much. Before we move on to the other poets, the four giants, I want to give the listeners just a taste of the gems that you have in the notes section of this book. And I'm going to refer, on page 364, you include the only other female Jewish poet that we know of, although she's not part of this group.
Right. She's not part of the group because she wrote in Arabic.
Okay. And you have two poems here. We don't know who she is. She might be the daughter of one of the four giants, Shumel Hanagid, correct?
Shumel.
Oh. Did you give this poem a title also? Because I know you gave the other poems in the collection their titles. Or did this one have a title?
None of the poems. Basically, what you have in the Hebrew is what you have in the Arabic. Mm-hmm. The Arabic poems also don't have titles.
Okay.
So I gave these titles.
You know. So why don't you go ahead and read her poem?
Yeah. This is, some scholars think that this might be by the daughter of Shmuel Hanagid, and others disagree. There's a problem with the dating, but we do have a name for this woman, and her name is Kasmuna bint Ismael al-Yehudi, and that means Kasmuna, the daughter of Ismael, the Jew.
Ah.
Shmuel Hanagid's name in Arabic, all these poets had Arabic names also, his name in Arabic was Ismael. Mm-hmm. Ismael the Jew. It's very possible that also a man like Hanagid would have wanted his daughters educated in this way. We know that he took great pains to make sure his sons were properly educated in poetry. We'll get to that later, perhaps. But so it's possible that this is his daughter. In any case, she's a marvelous poet. Unseeing herself in the mirror. I see an orchard where the time has come for harvesting, but see no gardener reaching out a hand. Youth passes, vanishing, and there remains alone one I will not name.
Well, let's move on to the first giant of Hebrew mm-hmm. verse who might be her father. Would you tell us a little about Hanagid before we read some of his poems?
Yeah, Shmuel Hanagid is really a kind of a legendary figure in all ways. As I mentioned, his name in Arabic was Ismail ibn Nagrela or Nagrela. And in Hebrew, the name or title Hanagid means the Nagid, it means the governor. He is the ruler or the leader of Spanish Jewry in the entire Iberian Peninsula. In addition to that, he, largely by virtue of his skill as an Arabic prose writer, but also, one stands to reason, his wisdom and his knowledge of men and his way with people, he rose through the ranks of the Granadan administration, was attached to courts in Malaga and then in Granada, and he eventually rose to the position of prime minister of the Muslim state of Granada and commander of its army. So you have a Jew in the early 11th century who is the head of state, head of a Muslim state, the leader of its army. Granada was one of the most powerful city-states in Spain, in southern Spain, and who was also a major scholar of religious law. And if all that weren't enough, he was also one of the greatest poets in the history of Hebrew, perhaps the greatest. In my mind, he may be the greatest.
Why don't we start with On Fleeing His City?
Mm-hmm. On Fleeing His City is a poem that he wrote as a very young man. It's the earliest poem in his collected poems that we have. I should also say that Hanagid, the discovery of Hanagid's work is also miraculous. We did not have Hanagid's work. Pretty much for the better part of 1,000 years was lost. There are some references to him within 100 years of his own death, talking about him as a great poet, but there's very little historical record of the actual poems. In the early 20th century, a manuscript with his collected work was discovered in a crate in Europe. A bookseller came across it, and that's how it was. Actually, was not published in an accessible version for someone who could read Hebrew until the mid-1940s, I believe. He's a kind of contemporary poet.
Mm-hmm.
And this poem, On Fleeing His City, was written when he was a young man. There was a civil war in Cordoba. And as he fled Cordoba and eventually went to Malaga, and he wrote this poem. What's curious, interesting is that we have a poem that's very much like it, written by an Arab poet, who also, as a young man, was fleeing Cordoba, the same civil war. Mm. They use the same materials, but they come up with very, very different poems. On Fleeing His City. Spirit splits in its asking, and soul in its wanting is balked. And the body fattened is vital and full, its precious being uneasy. So the modest man walks on earth, his thought drawn toward the sky. What good is the pulse of man's flesh and its favors when the mind is in pain? And the friends who frame me, their fine physiques and slender thinking it's ease or gain that drives me, pitching from place to place, my hair wild, my eyes charcoaled with night, and not a one speaks wisely, their souls blunted or blurred, goat-footed thinkers. Should someone unguilty hold back from longing toward heights like the moon? Should he wait, binding its wings to his waist like a man winding his sash about him, till he acts in the hear of his action, as he adds and then adds like the sea to his fame? By God and God's faithful, and I keep my oath. I'll climb cliffs and descend the innermost pit, and sow the edge of desert to desert, and split the sea and every gorge, and sail in mountainous ascent until the word forever makes sense to me, and my enemies fear me, and my friends in that fear find solace. Then free men will turn their faces toward mine as I face theirs, and soul will save us as it trips our obstructors. The beds of our friendship are rich with it, planted by the river of affection and fixed like a seal in wax, like graven gold in the window dome of the temple. May Yah be with you as you love, and your soul, which he loves, be delivered. And the God who sends salvation shield you till the sun and the moon are no more.
There are also two short poems by him that I think are really remarkable. Those are First War and The Market.
First War is actually a poem by an Arab poet that Hanagid has, whose poem Hanagid has adapted to Hebrew. It's a beautiful poem. I think it's a kind of timeless poem. It certainly speaks to our own time and our own situation now. First war resembles a beautiful girl we all want to flirt with and believe. Later it's more a repulsive old whore whose callers are bitter and grieve. The Market is actually one of my favorite poems. I think it's one of Hanagid's finest poems. It comes from his third collection, which he wrote as an older man, and it's a book of wisdom literature, essentially. And this is a marvelous combination in this. There's a marvelous combination in this poem of the concrete and the contemplative. It begins very much in a concrete situation and then zooms out and sees what it all means. It's essentially a poem about a market he walked through. It could be a Middle Eastern market today. Stands to reason that this was a market in Granada. And the last line of the poem is taken directly from the book of Ecclesiastes. And in Hanagid's work, this poem comes from a larger book, which is called After Ecclesiastes. So he's very much modeling himself on that book of wisdom literature. I crossed through a market where butchers hung oxen and sheep side by side. There were birds and herds of fatlings like squid, their terror loud as blood congealed over blood and slaughterers' knives open veins. In booths alongside them the fishmongers and fish in heaps and tackle like sand, and beside them the street of the bakers whose ovens are fired through dawn. They bake, they eat, they lead their prey, they split what's left to bring home. And my heart understood how it happened and asked, who are you to survive? What separates you from these beasts which were born in new waking and labor and rest? If they hadn't been given by God for your meals, they'd be free. If he wanted this instant, he'd easily put you in their place. They've breath like you and hearts, which scatter them over the earth. There was never a time when the living didn't die, nor the young that they bear not give birth. Pay attention to this, you pure one. And princes so calm in your fame, know if you'd fathom the worlds of the hidden, this is the whole of man.
You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. I'm Catherine Hastings. My guest today is Peter Cole, editor and translator of a wonderful book published by Princeton University Press, The Dream of the Poem, Hebrew Poetry from Muslim and Christian Spain, 950 to 1492. Let's return now to Peter Cole.
Well, let's move on to another one of those giants, Shlomo ibn Gaberol. Is that correct?
Right.
He was called, quote, the spectacular fly in the ointment of the refined 11th century Andalusian Jewish elite. Why is this?
Well, I called him that, first of all.
Oh, it's you.
Yeah. Okay. He was pretty much everything that Hanagid wasn't. He was a kind of introverted, cranky misanthrope who wrote spectacular verse about cosmically fabulous things. He was the great metaphysical and religious poet, philosophical poet, also the great poet of nature and understanding nature's place in the ordered world. And yet when it came to getting along with others, to social relations, he was not a happy camper. And he basically fought with just about everyone he came across. So that's the fly in the ointment. He did not suffer fools gladly and often wrote about them.
He has a beautiful poem called Now the Thrushes.
Yeah, this is one of those very quiet nature poems. He's got some really extraordinary, some of the finest nature poems in the entire canon. This is a poem, in fact, I hadn't planned to translate for this book. And another friend of mine in Jerusalem asked me about it. He said, oh, did you see that poem? And I said, I had missed it. I went back and went, it's a very beautiful little poem. And in this translation, I actually encode a little homage to Thomas Hardy, because he wrote about similar situations.
Yes.
And so what you see here is a kind of animation of nature, a sense of nature as being part of a larger plan or a larger design. Now the thrushes. Now the thrushes have gathered to sing on the sprigs without thinking. How could you hear their song in the trees and not be glad with all you've got and start drinking? What could be better than branches renewed by time with buds peeking into the garden? When a wind comes on, they nod to each other, it seems, as though they were speaking.
Let's move to They Asked Me As Though They Were Mystified.
Yeah, that's a poem about his patron. And Ibn Gaberol was a real prodigy. By the age of 16, he was writing very impressive poems that were being sent all over the Jewish world. He knew he was great, and he reminded people about it all the time. And his patron, who had really taken him in from very early on, died at the age of 99. And he wrote several elegies to him. This is the shortest of them, I think. They asked me as though they were mystified. And there's an image here of hands being like clouds. And this is a classic Arabic image, an image taken from Arabic poetry. Clouds open up and give rain. Hands open up and give support. They asked me as though they were mystified. Is it true your friend's hands are like clouds? And I told them they were tied for being too open and for goodness of heart. Of hunger, he died.
Stunning. No, it's such a short piece, and it packs such a powerful punch.
Yeah. Well, a lot of this poetry, really, these poets get at what's essential very quickly.
Well, I'd like to take a slight departure from the four giants for a minute, though we'll come back to the other two that are left. But there's a poet by the name of Yehudi Al-Harizi. He lived apparently from 1165 to about 1225. I say these years because it just astounds me that we have this. You know, we have so much information now from such a long time ago. It's absolutely mind-blowing. But he has a series of five very short poems in two voices, all set out a verse and lay the foundation. Then you'll add one for the stanza's completion. This is a wonderful title that you've given this, because it tells us what's going on.
In this case, I didn't give the title. This is Al-Harizi's. It's not exactly a title. This is the heading that he gave the poem in rhymed prose, and so I've essentially rhymed it as well. But it is Al-Harizi's. And I should say, you're right in saying that there are four great poets of the so-called Golden Age. But other scholars will also talk about three other great poets, major poets, who came after that in the age of Christian Spain, Hebrew poetry in mm-hmm. Christian Spain, and Al-Khwarizmi is one of them. He's a marvelous, marvelous poet.
Well, this poem apparently is structured like it's a little competition in a way. A younger man reads mm-hmm. a stanza, an older man continues with a completing stanza.
Right, and it is a kind of competition. It's a literary competition. Yeah.
Well, why don't I be the young man?
Okay.
And you can be the old, grizzled, wise one.
Okay. Okay. The principle here, I should say, is that the old man is putting the young man in his place. The young man comes up with a verse, with two lines, and this is the kind of literary competition that was fairly common then. And then the second person, in this case the old man, has to complete the verse by coming up with two lines that echo the first two and use the same rhyme, so that it closes the poem. And the young man is a good poet, but the old man is a better poet. And he does something very subtle each time to add a little more heft to the imagery and so forth.
Okay, I'll start reading. Mm-hmm. The writer's pen across the scroll lays down darkness in its wrath.
Like a snake that slithers across the dust and leaves behind it a level path.
The hawk downs eagles high in the skies, spreading its pinions against the heavens.
Its eyes are cut from precious gems, its flashing wings from bolts of lightning.
The waters slowly flow in the stream, just like delicate chains of silver.
And the hand of the wind, like a craftsman, comes and turns that elegance into armor.
Hidden from men and always veiled, the pomegranate's cheeks are just like girls.
Once they're opened, it seems they contain coffers loaded with gold and pearls.
The fruit of the nut is sweet in its shell, but until it's broken, it can't be eaten.
Much like those who seek like fools and learn not a thing until they're beaten.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Have you seen other examples of poems written this way during this time period?
Yes, a few, not quite with a kind of call and response, but there are quite a few competitions. Some of them get fairly nasty.
Oh, really? Yeah, true competition.
They're not necessarily for the radio.
Yes. Okay, we'll pass those by. Doggone it. Okay, let's move on to another of the four giants, Moshe Ibn Ezra.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's called the representative of the Spanish Hebrew Golden Age. Why is this?
Well, he's the most representative in the sense that more than any of the other poets, he completely or more fully embodies the ideal of Arabic poetry. He takes the Arabic images and makes the greatest use of them. He really is in many, many ways, when he's writing secular poetry, an Arab poet writing in Hebrew. And he even takes a lot of those Arabic tropes and introduces them into his religious poetry.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to speak for a moment just about who he was as a man and poet, and then we can turn to a couple of his poems?
Sure. Ibn Ezra was born and raised in Granada in an aristocratic family. He spent most of his youth, first half of his life, in the south. And then with the invasion of the Almoravids, a less tolerant Muslim group from North Africa, most of his family fled to the north. And Ibn Ezra and his immediate family was left in the south. And something happened. We're not sure what. He appears to have had some sort of family scandal. The records talk about a female cousin. It's not clear.
Ah.
And he himself then went up north, and he spent the whole second half of his adult life in isolation, pretty much all by himself up north. The north of Spain was then considered the cultural level was much lower than the south. He felt that he was surrounded by boors, that he really had no intellectual company there. And he wrote about this kind of life in exile embittered, missing his family, some very tender poems to his children. And his, for whatever reason, his children and his, possibly going back to this scandal, and his brothers, nobody wanted to have anything to do with him. So he was stuck up there in the North. He writes about longing for the South in a curious way. He writes about it in the same way that other poets will write about longing for Jerusalem. For him, the South of Spain, Andalusia, that culture of what's called convivencia, of coexistence, of living together, all these three cultures coming together, for him, that was the lost ideal, the lost world. So, but he spent the rest of his adult life, as they say, in the North.
Why don't you read If You See Me?
If You See Me is one of his later poems, and he has quite a few contemplative poems that are fairly bleak from this period. You can imagine why. This poem, contemplative poems in this tradition, tend not to be, at least as they're inherited from the Arabic tradition, tend not to be personal. They tend to be transpersonal. They could apply to any kind of situation. But much as we saw with Hanagide in the market, he combines here a personal situation with that larger philosophical perspective, and that gives the poem, I think, some added bite. If You See Me. It's addressed to his son, but it's fairly clear that his son is not going to see this poem. If You See Me. If you see me in my grave, my son, locked in a cell, a pit, my home, in a hole where no one goes or comes, held like prey in the claws of dust, my face ravaged, its dignity gone, the worms like a mantle over my flesh, you will not know then who I am, for darkness will have come through my skin. How could my loved ones have been so distant and my brothers treated me like a stranger? Like them, my sons have left me behind as I abandon my parents in anger. They've only a while to live on earth. Their fate tomorrow will be like mine. They'll be devoured by death's firstborn, their memory here on earth forgotten. For a man who fathers 1,000 children is just like one, in the end, who's barren.
Let's move on to another one of his poems. It's a short poem called A Shadow.
A Shadow is a very beautiful poem, essentially a nature poem, a poem about a garden. But as with a lot of these poems, these poets all inherited certain genres, and then they did things with these genres that put their individual stamp on it. So this becomes much more than just a nature poem. It really becomes a poem about time, about meditation on the passing of time and one's own life. And you have to remember here that we're talking about Andalusian winter, which is to say the rainy season. And then the rainy season passes, and you have spring and summer, the dry season. So this is not a North American winter. Mm-hmm. It's Andalusian winter, and then spring. Winter's cold has fled like a shadow, the driving rain with its riders and troops, and high in its circuit the sun and the ram now sits like a king at his feast. The hills have put on turbans of blossoms, the plain its robes of grasses and herbs, wafting fragrances up to our faces, all winter they'd held within. So pass the cup which will raise my joy and raise the grief that lies in my heart. My tears will weaken its fire's flames, for anger burns in it still. Fear fortune, whose gifts are venom, mixed with a little nectar and sweetness. Deceive yourself with its goodness by morning, then wait for reversal by dusk. Drink through the day until it turns, and the sun coats its silver with gold, and by night until it flees like a moor, as dawn's hand grasps its heel.
Thank you. The next poem, called The Fawn, reminds me that there is this image of a fawn that I see throughout this book by different poets.
Right.
Why is that? Why the fawn? And then you can read the poem, mm-hmm. for sure.
The fawn has different names. There's a fawn, the gazelle, the doe, the deer, all these things. And it is an image taken from Arabic poetry, again, from Arabic love poetry. It also comes to a certain extent from the Song of Songs, where the speaker in one place will say, my beloved is like a gazelle on the hills. Mm-hmm. And it's an image of beauty. It's true that we see it throughout, and scholars have often debated. Sometimes you get a sense that there are all these poets for 500 years are writing about the same young thing that they'd like to get their hands on. But that's not the case. This is it's a literary convention, but that doesn't make the work conventional. This is important to keep in mind. These poets, again, inherited a given convention. It's what they do with it. It's how they animate it.
Exactly.
With their language, with the imagery around it, that determines the worth of the poem. Mm-hmm. So in this case, he's writing about a handsome fawn, which is, say, a young man. There's a good deal of homoeroticism in this poetry, which also surprises a lot of people. They don't associate this with Judaism. And in fact, it is fairly unique to this period. But homoeroticism also comes from the Arabic tradition. It's embraced, it's welcomed, it's to be seen in sort of Greek sense, in a Greek mm-hmm. philosophical sense. There's still a great deal of controversy about it. There's a difference between homoeroticism and homosexuality. And these poems are, for the most part, homoerotic, not homosexual. Mm. But they're really at heart... they don't tell us what the poets did or didn't do. That we have to leave suspended. Maybe they did all kinds of things. But that's not what it says in the poem. The poems are essentially about a relationship to beauty, to sensuality, to one's environment, in all situations, regardless of who's involved.
Right.
The fawn. As the cup rides his hand to his mouth, turn and look at that handsome fawn. He raises it so to his face, and I see the sun being kissed by the moon.
Beautiful. Now, you gave titles to these poems yourself, and there is one poem that it struck me as a rather light poem, and you gave it a title that sounds very contemporary and a little humorous to me, and that is a poem by Yosef Ibn Zabara called My Ex.
My Ex, yes. Zabara lived in mid to late 12th century in the Christian north, the north of Spain, and he wandered a good deal in Spain. Part of the thing with the titles is, as I said, the original poems don't have titles. I wanted to have some fun with the titles and make it very clear that these are my titles.
Mm-hmm.
And why not? I'm not pretending to, while the translations are very faithful, they're translations, they're done by somebody in the 21st century, and it doesn't hurt to remind people about that. In terms of the lightness, there are a lot of light poems in the book. Again, people hear medieval, Jewish, they get very solemn and think it's going to be all very heavy poetry. That's not the case at all. A lot of it's very funny, sometimes very bawdy, and this is a case, this is from a narrative book that Ibn Zabara wrote, and into the narrative he intersperses little poems here and there. And this is one about the woman he used to be married to, my ex. A demon was drawn in that woman's face, and her beauty cut into my organs and limbs. Whenever she spoke, my hair stood up straight, as the intricate links of my heart wore thin. She shut the gates of affection and peace, opened the door to strife, and we fought. She set out her dwelling on a hill of complaint, pitching her tent and stretching it taut. She weighed on my heart like the sands of the sea, and as though she were cooking, boiled my belly.
Well, there's another poem by Yehudi Halevi, When Alone, Silver Hair. Mm. This is another incident, I think, that has some humor. It's a meditation on aging, but it definitely has a little
right.
humor.
This is one of Halevi's lighter poems. Halevi was the most famous poet of the period, although not necessarily the greatest poet to my mind. He was certainly one of the four greatest. And he's more famous for his poems in which he writes about longing for Zion and so forth. But he also wrote in a very, as I say, light, humorous mode. He's got lots of riddles and other poems like that. And this one is about aging. And this was also a topic, a trope taken from Arabic poetry, somebody's hair going gray. When a lone silver hair appeared on my head, I plucked it out with my hand, and it said, "You've beaten me one-on-one, but what will you do with the army to come?"
But that's a poem I can put on my mirror these mm-hmm. days. It's great. Now, he was the last of the four major poets,
right.
Halevi. Is there anything you want to tell us about him in particular?
Well, he's, as I say, a major figure, part of both because of his mastery of the Andalusian technique. He was a complete master of all the different forms. But he's also noteworthy for, at the end of the period of the Golden Age, we're talking about 1130, 1140 now, he basically comes to the conclusion that the whole thing was a big mistake. That this notion that Hebrew and Arabic culture could somehow be fused was going to end up in the destruction of Jewry, and that it was really, it may have been well-meaning, but it wasn't something, even on the literary level, it wasn't something that brought out the best in the Hebrew poets, because they were spending so much time trying to adapt themselves to Arabic literary principles. And so he got in his mind, and he also writes about this in a famous book of philosophy called the Kuzari. He decides to leave Spain behind altogether, and he sets sail for Palestine, which was then, Jerusalem was then controlled by the Crusaders. It stood to reason that he knew he couldn't enter Jerusalem or stay in Jerusalem, but he wanted to go and worship at the site of the ruined temple.
Also from the section of the book that includes the poets of Christian Spain and Provence, there's Avraham Abulafia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's known as one of the major figures in history of Hebrew mystical tradition, and I learned from reading your notes that he wrote the Book of the Letter, which is a 1,400-line poem. It's a Kabbalistic work,
right.
Correct? It must have been really difficult for you to choose some lines from a 1,400-line poem to put into this book.
It was. I translated a lot more than I ended up putting in the book. And it's a particularly wild, almost hallucinogenic poem. There's really nothing else like it in the book. Abulafia is known as one of the most important Kabbalists of Spain. His particular kind of mysticism was very language-oriented. So he's somebody who interests poets a great deal, and he often works in a great deal about language and letters and the Hebrew vowels into his work.
He wrote, "Blood is the name of your soul, and ink is the name of your spirit."
Right, that's from a section about the battle between ink and blood.
Yeah, interesting. Well, would you like to read part of the Book of Letters?
Sure.
The Book of the Letters,
did you have
excuse
a,
me.
I'll read from that section, the battle of ink and blood. And essentially this is about a kind of war within somebody, a war within a person's soul, a psychomachia, it's called. Different aspects of a person's desires are fighting here. I'll say the word, the name of God, Yahweh, and he writes out Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, but I can't stop and say that every time, so. And Yahweh, and he manipulates those letters in all kinds of magical ways. And Yahweh spoke to me when I saw his name spelled out and merged with the blood in my heart, separating blood from ink and ink from blood. And Yahweh said to me, "Behold, blood is the name of your soul, and ink the name of your spirit. Your father and mother are vessels for my name and a sign." And then I fathomed the tremendous difference between my spirit and soul, and a great joy came through me. For I knew my soul was dwelling in the redness as blood, and my spirit was dwelling in the blackness as ink. And there raged a war in my heart between the blood and ink, the blood from the wind and the ink from dust, and the black ink over the blood was victorious, as the Sabbath subdues all the days of the week. And so my heart rested within me, and I offer praise to the Lord, to the name in my heart, forever.
Thank you so much. Well, we have time for probably one more poet and one more poem. Would you like to choose someone yourself?
Let's see. Yes, okay. I think maybe since we've gone into such depth about poets from all different periods and gone up to Abulafia, which is to say up until the late 13th century, towards the very, very end of this period, which ends with the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, at the very tail end, there is one poet writing in Granada. Granada is the only place on the Iberian Peninsula left that's still Muslim. The rest of the Christian reconquest has taken back the rest of the peninsula. And in the by then fairly small city-state of Granada, scholars believe that there may have been about 500, 550 Jews left. The finest poet there was a man named Sa'adia ibn Dinan, who at the very end of this period is asked by somebody to write a little treatise about Arabic meters. And it's odd that only once before that in the history of the in all of the 500 years has anybody written anything about the meters. In other words, they just knew them. Mm-hmm. Now that it was disappearing, there was a need to write it down. So Ibn Dinan writes a little booklet about the meters, explaining them and demonstrating them. But he does something curious. He writes two different versions of the book. One in Arabic, where all the explanations are in Arabic, and then he composes Hebrew poems to demonstrate each meter. This is how it's done. And then he writes another version that's in Hebrew. The explanations are in Hebrew, but the poems, again, are in Hebrew as well. But each one has different poems. The Hebrew explanations are accompanied by moralistic and didactic poems.
Oh.
And the Arabic book is accompanied by erotic poems, very much from the Arabic tradition.
How interesting.
So I'll close with two very short poems from Ibn Dinan's book. She trapped me. She trapped me with temptation's bread. With stolen water she hunted me down, her angel's eyes looking at me were archers slowly taking aim. Now her cheeks are the breaking dawn, now her hair brings evening on. And finally, chiasmus for a doe. In my lap a doe. We have another one of those fawns or does.
Yes.
In my lap a doe. And in her lap, a harp. She plays it with her fingers and kills me with her heart.
Well, before we leave, I want to point out to everyone that you are not only a translator and someone who clearly has had great passion for pulling a work like this together, you are a poet yourself. And you have your a third book of poems coming out in the fall of next year from New Directions called Things on Which I've Stumbled. So people should keep their eyes out for that book. Peter Cole, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you've been listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guest today was Peter Cole, who translated, edited, and introduced The Dream of the Poem, Hebrew Poetry from Muslim and Christian Spain, 950 to 1492, published by Princeton University Press. If you have comments or questions about tonight's show, please email me at khastings@wordtemple.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening. Thank you.